Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. A man who serves God and his kingdom with great effect, as well as devotes incalculable time and energy to protecting the country we love against those enemies, both foreign and domestic, I'm very pleased to say, is our first guest today. His name is Kevin Freeman. He is, among other things, the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, an economic warfare specialist, a man who has, in a variety of capacities, contributed enormously to everyone else's situational awareness about economic warfare, notably through his television program, but also his books, which include Secret Weapon, Game Plan, and most recently, According to Plan. You can find out much more about Kevin's work at economicwarroom.com, including taking aboard his superb battle plans that he prepares for each of his programs with his team. Kevin, it's great to have you with us. As always, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be with you.
A lot to talk about in the economic battle space. Let's start with what has happened in recent days, Kevin, since our last visit, with not one but two American regional banks, the first being the so-called Silicon Valley Bank, the second being
Signature Bank.
I've lost the name of it. Signature Bank, of course, Signature Bank. And now Credit Suisse is in the mix, and the problems may be metastasizing further. I know you did a very important program on how all of this could set the stage for the Great Reset about a year or so ago. Tell us about your insights in that program.
Let me be clear. I didn't predict Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, or Credit Suisse a year ago. What I said, it was March 3rd, 2022, was that the Great Reset would likely be ushered in by an economic financial crisis, a banking crisis, where we might see banks start to fail again. And people would then rush to a digital dollar. They would rush to some level of protection from the government. We'd nationalize banks and so forth. I said that the powers that be would use a banking crisis. And I wouldn't have predicted Silicon Valley Bank especially. I know they're woke, and they clearly are, but they have a great franchise in that they were the bank to the venture capital community, and they are big Democratic supporters. And, you know, one might have thought that they might be a unique bank that would survive, but there was a run on the bank caused by a Twitter feed. And, you know, the bank just made some, I guess, calculated decisions. They went too long in their portfolio, in their bond portfolio, and when interest rates rose, it hurt their capital position a bit. And then there was the venture capital community that panicked like babies and said, oh, let's get out. But it showed the weakness of the financial system, the fractional banking that we have, and it also may have been a hit on cryptocurrency because they're very big in decentralized finance. And if you're going to usher in a central bank digital currency, you know, Biden bucks, a digital dollar, you've got to push all the competition out of the way, including cryptocurrency.
I love that term, Biden bucks. Kevin, tell us how this central bank digital currency would operate in this kind of post-regional banking environment. Who are the winners? Who are the losers? And is that in fact now decidedly?
Well, it is absolutely in prospect. The president wrote an executive order last year that mandated a look at this. The Federal Reserve has been testing central bank digital currencies. And their argument is that the entire world is going that way. China is developing the digital yuan and all other nations are looking at digital currency. So we have to do it. That's not the frightening part. The frightening part is the realization by the Federal Reserve and others that this could mean complete control over every person's money and spending, so that literally they could turn your money off if they don't like what you're doing, if they think you're overweight and you shouldn't eat a cheeseburger, if they don't like you traveling beyond a certain area, if you have a favored political stance, if you do an unfavored political stance like the Trump truckers, that were saying we don't want the vaccine in Canada. We'll just close your bank account. This gives full monetary control, which gives effective control over every aspect of our lives. That is the threat. And if you put a central bank digital currency without some type of protections for that, that's what we'll end up with, is dictatorship from the government.
Yeah. Kevin, I want to come back to that point after a short break here in a moment, but just to drill down for a second on it, what you've just described is not the, you know, ruminations or projections of some wildly inventive individual. You're talking about something, and this takes nothing away from you for having laid this out a year ago, but you're talking about what the Chinese Communist Party has done with its social credit system, as it's called. And we've seen it work. You mentioned in Canada, yes, but we've seen it work in, you know, Shanghai and places in China as well, in a manner that absolutely crushes, you know, the individual, such freedoms as they might enjoy. And it's hard to imagine it could possibly be insinuated here. The thing that I love about you and your team at Economic War Room, Kevin, is that you're not just inclined to warn about problems. You are determined to try to do something about them. I mentioned your battle plans that accompany each of your programs, which are just absolutely incredibly important, really encouraging people to take specific steps as well as take away certain information. But talk about one of your most important initiatives, I believe, and that is the Texas Transactional Gold Initiative.
Yeah, well,
and how it relates,
Frank,
to all of this.
As you say, we don't like to just be talking heads and say, here are the problems. We like to come up with solutions. It's an economic war room, and we go on offense as well as defense at times. And what we've proposed, and what Senator Brian Hughes in Senate Bill 2334 in Texas and House Bill 4903, which is Mark DeRazio's bill, it says basically Texas can take its bullion depository and turn it to have certain banking features to make gold transactional. At present, you can take gold and silver, drive to Leander, Texas, and hand it to them, and they will hold it for you on reserve as a depository. This bill would make it possible for that to be transactional so that you could deposit gold. But you, not just by driving there, you could actually write a check or electronically send them your U.S. dollars. They would convert it to gold and they would hold it for you until you wanted to spend it. And then you could take a debit card, go to a restaurant. I've done this with a commercial version of this, and you could buy your dinner for 3.5 grams of gold, is what I did in Colorado Springs the other night. The Italian restaurant had no idea I was paying them in gold. I just pulled out, it's a MasterCard. They paid for the dinner, and the money came out of my account. Now, if you do that at the state level, you have additional levels of security. You have constitutionality, because the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10 says a state can make gold and silver coins legal tender. And you have privacy. You have a protection. You have a safe place to put your money that's not fractional banking. It's not like Silicon Valley Bank or all the other banking system. It's there guaranteed on reserve by the state of Texas, and every state can do this. So we've pushed for these bills. It's taken 15 years, but we're about to see a new era in the United States and in Texas.
Kevin, we almost are at a break, but very quickly, there is one other feature of this. If you do it in the manner that you've talked about with the state backing, and that is that it's advantageous from a tax point of view over doing it any other.
Yeah, that's true, right? Because while they hold the gold, if gold goes up in value, you don't get taxed on it because it's tender. That means it's money, and you don't have to pay income tax on the gain. Now, any money you put in there, you have to pay tax to get it in, and in the end, you may pay tax in other ways. But you don't have capital gains for the gold increase while they hold it.
Yeah, which is a fact of life in the gold and other precious coins business. Kevin Freeman, this is so exciting, and it's a function of your hard work and that of your team. Thank you for both what's now made possible, these legislative initiatives in the state of Texas, and the model that they are going to represent for the rest of the world. We'll be back with more with Kevin Freeman right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the contents of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at Salem Media, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case, money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back. The great Kevin Freeman is in the house virtually. We've caught up with him in his economic war room in the state of Texas. We are talking with him about some of the important work that it is engaged in, including how you can invest in Texas transactional gold, hopefully very soon, and thereby have confidence in your currency and not be enslaved by what the federal government seems to have in mind for you with a central bank digital currency. Kevin, I want to switch gears with you, if I can, to the sort of overarching problem that you, as a very important member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, well as a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, or I know is seized with, as am I, and that is the threat we face from the Chinese Communist Party. And I wanted to talk with you a little bit about, a warning, I guess it's fair to say, that was issued by Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, at the end of a recently concluded National People's Congress, in which he was actually set up for another five-year term as president of Communist China, not just the general secretary of its Communist Party. He talked about reforming and developing global governance. And I'd be interested in your thoughts about how that fits in with a lot of the other things that we talk about on this program a lot. The Great Reset, for one, the World Economic Forum and its agenda, and more generally, these various supranational entities, the United Nations and some of its subsidiaries, like the World Health Organization. Are those all helpmates in what is pretty clearly Xi's true agenda of not only affecting world governance, but running it?
Well, first off, it's an unprecedented third term as president. There's never been a three-term president before. They've changed the rules so that he can be dictator for life, Xi Jinping. And he's just following the playbook of unrestricted warfare, something we talk about all the time. It mentions in there, and you can find chapter and verse on it, where you want to take over the global organizations. Now, China would immediately balk if the United Nations came in and started limiting their capabilities. If the United Nations came in and said, no, Taiwan is a separate and independent country and you can't interfere in their affairs, they would immediately balk. They only like these supranational organizations when they're in control of them, when they serve their agenda and their purpose. And that's unfortunately the case. We saw it with the World Health Organization. We saw it absolutely when they refused to go in and force China to disclose what had happened in that Wuhan lab. We know that they have control in many parts of the United Nations and that they have literally made this a target over the last 20, 25 years as a part of their unrestricted warfare plan to make those organizations serve China, because they do not see China as a part of a greater world order. They see China on top of a greater world order. And they believe that's their natural right. That's the Xi Jinping view. Now, the Chinese people, they're not a problem. They're not a part of that. They're wonderful people. I have many Chinese friends, and you can tell that they are freedom-loving people. In fact, there are a lot of Christians in China that oppose this dictatorship. But this is a part of unrestricted warfare. There's no question in my mind.
And unfortunately, it is very far advanced. I think it wasn't really until we all were subjected to the biological warfare attack. You were a member of our Team B3 that described the COVID-19 pandemic as that, by the Chinese Communist Party, deliberately sending people they had confidence would be purveying the Wuhan virus to other parts of the world, including the United States. But once that broke, we began to discover just how much control the Chinese Communist Party exercises over this outfit, the World Health Organization, in the person of its Director General, Tedros Ghebreyesus, and its policies. Talk a little bit about that, Kevin, and in particular in the context of an effort now afoot, and you're very much involved in warning about it and helping push back against it, including with a terrific program you did with Michelle Bachmann, former congresswoman. But talk us through what the Chinese Communist Party's success in the COVID-19 context of bending the World Health Organization and through it the rest of the world to its will meant for, among other things, the institution of something we talked about earlier, that social credit system is part of the China model.
Well, Frank, I saw this firsthand. Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, when he was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, invited me in to talk about the threat of unrestricted warfare economically. He also had the head of the China House, Lonnie Henley at the time, in DIA, brought in to debate me the number two at the World Bank, who was a Chinese national, and Michael Swain from the Carnegie Institute for International Affairs or Peace, or one of those, you know, long-sounding names. The truth is, both of them were completely sold out on the benign nature of China and how China was superior morally to the United States and how China would lead. And this is number two at the World Bank and the head of one of the, you know, the big think tank organizations here in the United States, both completely captured by China. So I saw it firsthand. Now, we had the debate. I brought up unrestricted warfare, and, you know, I don't mean to be immodest, but they were wrong, and we won the debate. I mean, General Flynn afterwards said, Kevin, you won that. I'm a money manager from Texas, for goodness sake. And yet they were able to take that line into the DIA, and we had to combat it. What they've done with the World Health Organization is even more insidious, because lives have been lost by the slow response that happened. We saw that in the team that you put together, Team B, and evaluated. And you're right, with Michelle Bachmann, we had her on because she's at Regent University and she's leading the charge to help people become aware that if the World Health Organization puts in into place these amendments that they're talking about, And I there may be some delay to the adoption of it. I don't know if that's true or not, but these amendments literally say that they have control over America in the event of a health crisis. And you say, okay, well, it's a pandemic. We should have a world global response. No, the answer is no. We saw that there were some other nations that had a better response than America, and we had a better response than others. If you make everybody do the same, you're going to go to the lowest common denominator. That's the first problem. Second problem is, everything can be described as a health crisis. If you have a natural gas stove in your house, that's a health crisis. That would give them effective control over race issues, over the economy, over the appliances we use, over our every aspect of our life, handed over to the World Health, which is guns, everything, which is China.
Yeah. And Kevin, I just want to commend to our audience once again, this book, The CCP Is at War with America, the Team B3 report, which, again, Kevin was a very important contributor to it. This is a document that I think persuasively argues we have been subjected to biological warfare. It's one of the charges that I'm waging as part of the new book. The indictment ought to be made a prosecutable offense at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. Kevin, 2 points quickly, and we've got a minute. You talked about the Chinese going after Christians. The persecution of them is rampant as part of the state's overall policy. And second, just the fact that as a money manager, you understand we have been responsible for underwriting a lot of these predations. Give us 35 seconds, if you could, quickly on it.
Yeah, number one, China may have more Christians in the world than any other nation, and yet they're under severe persecution by their government because the Communist Party cannot allow any worship of anything other than themselves. If you acknowledge that there's a power greater than them, then they lose all their authority. So that's the first problem. That's why they're destroying churches. And the second thing is, unfortunately, we Americans have been underwriting them through Wall Street. Wall Street was co-opted very early on, and our financial investment portfolios have been funding the Chinese Communist Party.
Right. And you're doing something about that as well with the National Security Consultants, Investment Consultants Initiative, nsic.org.com. Check it out, folks. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Come back to us soon if you would. You're always fabulous. Dede Loggison is up next. We'll talk about... Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest, a woman I have come to know, admire greatly, and work very closely with for the past, well, I don't know, three, 4 years, five, maybe now. Her name is Dede Loggison. She is an extraordinary human being in every respect, a woman of great faith and profound conviction, extraordinary skills, and I think clarity about the missions to which she devotes her energy that is, well, in a class by itself. I'm proud to say she is a colleague at our Committee on the Present Danger China, of which she is the executive secretary and the executive director of another organization I'm also proud to be associated with, Save the Persecuted Christians. She's been a guest on this program previously, but we're always happy to catch up with her, especially to take stock of a situation that is on her heart and mine and should be on all of ours, namely the persecution of Christians that is taking place on a massive scale on the continent of Africa, specifically in the nation of Nigeria. She has recently made a fact-finding mission to Nigeria on behalf of our Save the Persecuted Christians coalition, and we're anxious to catch up with her on what's her assessment of what's going on there, who's responsible, and what might be done about it. Dede, welcome back to Securing America. Always good to have you with us.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me here.
Tell us about your trip. Where did you go? How long were you there? And what did you see?
Well, Save the Persecuted Christians, as you know, Frank, has been advocating for the persecuted Christians in Nigeria for several years now. I went into Nigeria, into the heart of the most violent areas, Benue State and Plateau State. They're part of what's known as the Middle Belt of Nigeria. Nigeria has 210 million people. It's the largest economy in Africa. There's 50-50 Muslims and Christians, but since 2001, jihadists have been reigning in Nigeria. So I went there to see for myself the people that have been chased off of their homesteads, out of their villages. Their villages are literally being taken over by these jihadists. They're just subsistence farmers, and they're being pushed into what's known as internally displaced people's camps. I went where the U.S. government refuses to go. Each time they go on a fact-finding trip to Nigeria, they go to Abuja or to Lagos, but they don't go to where the people who have been most harmed are. And Benue State has over 1 million, some say 2.5 million internally displaced people. And they're just under incessant daily attacks, which you never hear about because the federal government of Nigeria does not want the international community to know the level of violence and harm that is taking place there.
And Didi, you're talking about Christians who are being persecuted basically for their faith, driven from their land, forced into these camps. When you say they're being subjected to daily attack, are they being attacked not only in their villages, but also in these camps?
Oh, absolutely. The camps are very insecure. They're full of thousands of children whose bellies are swollen. They are starving. They have nothing to eat. The state of Benue will drop off food and water once a month. And once that's gone, they have nothing. They are living on the ground in mosquito net tents that are literally strung up over twigs that they can find. Most of these are women and children who whose husbands have been slaughtered. Their children have been slaughtered. It's just the most horrific situation. And violence reigns every day.
Yeah, you mentioned that the government of Nigeria has been dominated by Muslims since 2001, I think you said. These are made up of the Fulani tribesmen, as I understand it, predominantly, who are perpetrating much of, if not the vast majority of this criminal activity, this persecution. What does the government say about what's going on here? And what, more to the point, is it doing, if anything?
Well, most Christians in Nigeria that I spoke to believe that the federal government of Nigeria is wholly complicit with the jihadists. President Muhammadu Buhari is a Fulani Muslim, and he has packed the entire administration, the agencies, the security agencies, and the courts top down with Fulani members of the tribe. So, and they are the strong Muslims in the north of Nigeria. There are Hausa Muslims as well, which Bola Ahmed Tinubu, who was just proclaimed the winner of the controversial elections in Nigeria, he's the successor to President Muhammadu Buhari, and they are complicit. Frank, they're the chosen. They're the chosen friends of the jihadists. And the jihadists we know in Benue State, FUNAM, the Fulani National Movement, threatened the people of Benue for the upcoming gubernatorial elections this weekend, that if their candidate for the APC doesn't win, they'll have even more attacks. And the government has done nothing to bring this leadership of this movement to arrest them and prosecute them. Nothing.
Yeah. You've suggested, at least implicitly, that there were problems with this election, but the problems that involve the accession of two Muslims, not as has been the case in the past, a Muslim in one role, president or vice president, the other being a Christian. Two Muslims, one of whom is aged and infirm, the other vigorous and dangerous, a man tied, I'm told, to Boko Haram, another horrific Islamist jihadist faction in Nigeria. If all of this is now going to be continuing under this new government, what is our government doing about this? If anything, we put an awful lot of taxpayer money into Nigeria each year, as I understand it. Please don't tell me that it's contributing to this problem, is it?
Well, not only that, Frank, the U.S. government through the State Department and USAID are the ones who have paid for the BVAS machines. Those are biometrical machines to verify voters, and the IREV system in which they were supposed to be able to see instantly the results from the polling units. All of that failed. So U.S. taxpayer money by the millions have been wasted in Nigeria's very unfree, unfair, and untransparent election.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's a drop in the bucket compared to the amount of money that we're pouring into the government of Nigeria, military assistance, among other things. And would you say, Didi, that we're turning a blind eye to what's going on with the connivance, if not the active complicity of the government, and that we're perhaps even helping to underwrite it as a result?
Not only is the U.S. government turning a blind eye, they're literally elevating the persecutors. They brought Muhammadu Buhari to Washington, D.C. for the U.S.-Africa Leadership Summit. And
I remember you standing up and confronting him with a sign,
yes,
no less, about
with a homemade
what
banner,
about the Christians.
Absolutely.
You were very, very
yes,
courageous in doing so. And you know, this was of a part of a piece with, you know, sort of the effort to romance this, well, jihadist, I guess you'd say, by our government. Talk a little bit about this country of particular concern standing that they had for a time, and certainly deserve at a minimum, if not actually to be declared a pariah, genocidal, jihadist regime.
Well, our coalition, Save the Persecuted Christians, worked very hard to get Nigeria listed on the State Department's International Religious Freedom list of countries of particular concern. And Secretary of State Blinken took them off of that list without any explanation or anything getting better. And we continue
on the eve of a trip there, as I recall.
On the eve of a trip there, yes. So he could make the political deals that that he thinks would benefit the United States. But really, it's just more money being poured into one of the world's most corrupt countries.
Indeed. So corrupt and imploding nation at that. And that will almost certainly, as our friend and colleague at the Save the Persecuted Christians Coalition, former Congressman Frank Wolf, has long warned, when Nigeria blows up, it will be mayhem for regions far beyond, throughout Africa, of course, but also Europe and probably here, as people flee. So, Didi, in the remaining minute we have, tell us a little bit about what we can do to try to help the people of Nigeria suffering in this manner.
Well, I would direct your audience to SaveThePersecutedChristians.org, where we recently held a webinar, a program called Nigeria's Descent into Chaos, How the Loss of Election Integrity is Emboldening the Terrorists. Because what if Nigeria implodes, as you said, it will create a refugee crisis that the Middle East will pale in contrast to that. And people are already fleeing Nigeria and not wanting to go back. And the violence, we know, especially if these elections continue to be contested and are even, in fact, overturned, violence will reign in Nigeria.
I fear it will reign just the same either way. But we appreciate so much your firsthand observation of what's going on there, your truthfulness about what is the likely implication of it, and the SaveThePersecutedChristians.org site as a vehicle for trying to help make come out better. God bless you, Didi. We'll talk with you soon. We'll be right back with more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, two Russian fighter aircraft intercepted and destroyed an expensive unmanned American aircraft in international airspace over the Black Sea. This was not, as the Pentagon would have us believe, an incident caused by Kremlin pilots' recklessness or unprofessionalism. Rather, it was a deliberate act designed to discourage the U.S. military from conducting legal and valuable intelligence collection against hostile powers with unarmed assets. It was also an ominous leading indicator of the erosion of our deterrence to acts of aggression. Russia isn't the first to thus demonstrate that America no longer operates from a position of assuring peace through strength. After all, the senior member of Vladimir Putin's No Limits partnership, the Chinese Communist Party, has been endangering even manned U.S. aircraft in the Pacific. Team Biden's feckless responses to date invite further testing of our perceived weakness and worse. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. Cheryl Chumley, one of our favorite guests here at Securing America, is in the house, praise the Lord, virtually, that is. She hails from the Washington Times, where she is the online opinion editor. She is also a columnist in that publication, which I admire greatly. She is, among other things, an author a number of times over, including most recently of Lockdown, the Socialist Plan to Take Away Your Freedom. Cheryl Chumley, it's great to have you back. Welcome once again.
Thank you for having me, Frank. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. So your book, Lockdown, is, of course, about what has been done to us at the hands of, well, the Chinese Communist Party and their proxy, the World Health Organization, with the active connivance of Anthony Fauci and the Centers for Disease Control and now the Biden administration. We can go in a lot of different directions, but I wanted to sort of start by doing a little stock taking on where you think we are on getting to the bottom of how this, you know, catastrophe was inflicted upon us, by whom, and what has flowed from it in terms of this lockdown and what the socialists have been making of it.
That's a really good question, very broad, and there's a lot to discuss there. And let's just start by looking at what Republicans now, holding the majority in the House, have been able to do. They've been able to drag out of the dark shadows, out of the dark corners that the mainstream media has largely ignored for over 3 years, the names and faces of those who have really brought forward the lies about the source of the virus itself. And many of us knew early on that the link between the Wuhan lab and Anthony Fauci and funding from the National Institutes of Health were all there, but the mainstream media was so busy putting forth propaganda and lies that it was difficult to discuss that openly because, as you know, Frank, you're booted off social media when you bring that up. Right. And so,
to the point that was not an accident. We've now learned, I think, from the Twitter files, among other things, that this was engineered, actually, by the Biden administration with those social media platforms and the media more generally. Is that right?
Yes. So many of the suspicions that we held for over 3 years about what was taking place with the left's exploitation of this virus to seize individual liberties is now coming to the forefront, and we're getting it in print. We're getting it on the record. We've got Elon Musk on Twitter opening the doors for discussion there. We've got Republicans in Congress holding hearings on the weaponization of government. Anthony Fauci, thankfully, is off the public stage, and we're starting to see his name brought forward in more truthful lights about how he flipped and flopped and deceptively sold this virus as something to greatly fear and lock down over for years. And so this is
because
all
of his own involvement
because
the generation of it, right?
Yeah, the balls are rolling in the right direction toward transparency, and that's all good for patriotic Americans.
Yeah, Well, needless to say, we want the Republicans in the House of Representatives to redouble their efforts to get to the bottom line of this, which is, as I believe it has been documented by our team B3, as we call it in a book called The CCP is at War with Us, America, that is. This was a biological warfare attack by the Chinese Communist Party against our country, and they need to be held accountable for that, which is the subject of a new book we've got coming out shortly called The Indictment. We'll talk more about that in the days to come. Cheryl, this brings me to, among other things, the sort of residual effects of these lockdowns. People are still wearing masks in large numbers around the country. They're still being encouraged to do so, even though it's now, I think, again, been amply documented that they do no good at all, that this is really a control mechanism. Tell us a little bit about what's the knock-on effect of all of that in New York City, something you wrote about in the Washington Times recently.
And something I wrote about way back when the masks were first coming to the forefront, that these are the criminals' best friends, right? Because now it's normal to see people walking about in public with not just face masks, but their faces fully covered with hoodies over their head and sunglasses and face masks that cover way more than just their nose and mouths. Nobody is suspicious of these people, and they're able in New York City, of note recently, to commit all these crimes and get away because, of course, cameras, surveillance cameras can't identify through the face mask. And it's gotten so bad in New York City that you even have the mayor and the administration there calling for stores to ban face masks for at least the entryway point for customers so the cameras can pick up their identities.
How ironic. Heretofore, we were being told you can't get into the store without a face mask. Now you can't get into the store with one. Is that the bottom line?
It's common sense. Come on.
It is common sense. Well, and the, suspension of common sense at the diktat, again, of the powers that be, or that were at least, has been such a blight on our freedoms more generally. Nobody's done a better job, I think, of really chronicling the toll that that has taken on our society than you have, Cheryl. I want to commend you for that.
Thank you.
Let me turn to the border. This is another topic that I know you've been very concerned about, and properly so, for quite some time. Alejandro Mayorkas is, of course, the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, and he has been a driving force behind the destruction, effectively, of our border and the invasion that has flowed from it. Tell us what he's now using to try to explain the invaders' motivation for coming here in such huge numbers.
Yeah, it's not Joe Biden's open door policy. It's climate change. It's weather patterns that are driving people into our country because, of course, when the weather is bad, when there's too much rain or too little rain, then that affects food supplies and the ability of farmers to grow food. So people naturally move where the food supply is, and that drives them across America's borders. Look, this is something the Democrats have been trying to advance for a very long time. I remember John Kerry under Barack Obama bringing forth the same type of argument that climate change was a national security issue because it was driving people across our borders and so forth. This is the lie of the left, and it has to be vocally fought.
It has to be, indeed. And we need to talk a bit more on the other side of a very short break, Cheryl Chumley, about Alejandro Mayorkas's future and whether he personally has to be held accountable by the United States Congress, and if so, whether that's likely to happen anytime soon. We'll talk about that and much more with Cheryl Chumley of the Washington Times on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are continuing our conversation with one of our favorite contributors here at Securing America, Cheryl Chumley, the online editor of the Washington Times. She is a formidable contributor to the public policy debate through her commentaries there, as well as the work she does editing other people's, and we're always pleased to have a chance to catch up with her. Cheryl, we were talking before the break about Alejandro Mayorkas and what I think you quite correctly describe as a lie that he has been promoting. Among others, he has indicated the border is secure. He's indicated that there's no problem with those coming across it, that everything's really under control. Nothing to see here, folks, move along. There seems to be a considerable appetite among people on Capitol Hill, and at least in the House of Representatives at the moment, who know that none of that is true, and who really regard it as prime evidence of malfeasance on his part, to say nothing of the effects of these policies, to seek his impeachment. Where does that stand? Do you think that's going to happen, and should it?
Well, to answer the last first, should it? Yes. You know, this is a guy who has openly lied, who has brazenly lied and been caught lying. If you go back a few months, there was that lie he made about the border agent whipping migrants as they crossed. And there was his use of that photo to advance a false narrative. He was outed for that. There were calls for his impeachment then. And of course, nothing happened because Republicans don't have enough support to go forward with something like that. But whether he should be impeached or not, I think if politicians and our elected officials openly lie, they should be impeached. That's an impeachable offense. And so I stand with go forward, but it's not going to happen.
Well, there's a two-part process, as you know, Cheryl. There's the impeachment in the House, which conceivably the Republicans could pull off all by themselves. And then there's conviction. The conviction process mm-hmm. that has to take place in the Senate, which is unlikely. But I'm with you. I think it should go forward in the House, and I hope we'll do so. Cheryl, one of the things that I think you've been making such a contribution on for many years now is helping to understand what's besetting our country, particularly in the form of what, for want of a better term, is spiritual warfare being waged against us. You've talked about Christians particularly being targeted. You've talked about Christians needing to stand up against some of what's being done to the America they love and the Constitution that, guarantees freedom of religion, among others. What I guess I'm interested in is your assessment of where we stand in that fight at the moment, in particular, just to look at a kind of microcosmic example of the struggle, is what is being done in the name of, transgenderism, as it's called euphemistically by the left. I believe Joe Biden just a day or so ago talked about it being a sin to prevent individuals who have a different gender identity than the one God gave them to get the so-called gender-affirming care that they need, which is more accurately described as physical mutilation. Is this an invocation of religion in a really obscene way, would you say? And how does that fit into the larger struggle that I know you're very concerned about, and properly so.
Yeah, I mean, really great questions there, Frank. And look, this all goes back to the fact that America was founded on a concept of God-given individual liberties. And in order to keep those individual liberties intact, you need to keep God at the forefront. So as we as a nation are turning more and more secular, of course, it's opening the door for biggest government to come in and tell us how to behave and act. And this is why you have such evils as this transgender movement being able to sprout and spread so very rapidly, because America has lost its moral grounding, its moral compass. We have turned toward government as being the provider of all, including the arbiter or determiner of moral behavior. And this is why you have the LGBTQ crowd making such inroads lately. What Joe Biden is saying is outright evil. He said those, he made those remarks in response to Governor Ron DeSantis's Florida push to reel back this child abuse called transgender medical procedures. And if people in America, specifically Christians, don't fight this openly now, it's going to be even more chaotic in the years to come.
Yeah. Well, chaotic is one way of thinking of it. Of course, it's destructive too. Most obviously, immediately, the individuals that are being mutilated, but
it's child abuse
of the society and of the families. And Cheryl, again, one of the other things that I really value of your insights is the degree to which you understand that these things are not as they often are represented as being some kind of sympathetic treatment of some, you know, mistreated minority. This is part of an agenda. I think of it as a Marxist agenda. And one of the most important targets for the Marxists, as you've documented as well as others, is, of course, the family. Could you talk a little bit about how this so-called transgenderist program is actually designed, or certainly has a profound effect on families, and harming them and displacing them as a kind of bulwark against an overreaching state?
Right. Well, if the family is the foundation of any society, which it is, right, then traditional family, where you have the biblical norms of a father and a mother in present in the home with children, is certainly God's ordained role of a family. And so, of course, the left wants to seek to upset that, to turn it over, to cripple it and crumble it so they can redefine family as they wish, which puts government in control, not God, of family. And the transgender movement at its base is designed, like you just pointed out, Frank, at upsetting this traditional family unit, which in turn upsets all of society.
Especially the idea that parents are not entitled to know that their children yes. want this surgery, let alone that they're having it.
Right.
I mean, this is just obscene on so many levels. Cheryl, as usual, the time has flown by. We are out of it, and we will have to say goodbye for the time being, but I hope you'll come back to us very soon. Thanks for the great work you do at the Washington Times. Your book, Lockdown, among others, is required reading, and we'll talk to you in the near future. Talk to the rest of you again, I hope, next time on Securing America. Until then, go forth and multiply.